This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer for the show, and Jason Croft at the controls for this hour. Kyle Mabry was on for hour number one. 12 million Americans suffer from food allergies, and our guest for this hour of the show, Sandra Beasley, is among them. She has multiple allergies. They're severe, and they've been part of her life almost from the start. When she was in the fourth grade, a nutritionist visiting her class said people like her were not really designed to survive. Well, she certainly has more than survived. She has thrived, going on to become an award-winning poet and writer. And this morning, she will share some stories from her life, some of the stories that she tells in her book, Don't Kill the Birthday Girl, Tales from an Allergic Life. Crown is the publisher. She's the author of the poetry collections I Was the Jukebox, the winner of the 2009 Barnard Women's Poets Prize, and also Theories of Falling, which won the 2007 New Issues Poetry Prize, and she's won some others for her work. She makes her home in Washington, D.C. She is visiting here in Champaign-Urbana, and in fact will be giving a reading on the campus this afternoon, 4:30 in the Illini Union Bookstore in the Author's Corner, so you can stop by and meet her that way. And here on the program, also, as we talk, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And you can send an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. That's the address. Thank you very much for being here.
Sure. Thrilled to join you.
We appreciate it. I thought the best way to start would be to have you read a bit from the very beginning of the book, Don't Kill the Birthday Girl.
I'm happy to. Okay. So this just opens up with the introduction to give you a sense of where the title, Don't Kill the Birthday Girl, Tales from an Allergic Life, comes from. There are only two birthdays that stand out in my memory as distinct, chronologically certain events. One, my 16th birthday, when we watched Ferris Bueller's Day Off. That was the year my friend Elizabeth, while using the swing anchored to the underside of our second-story deck, pushed off so hard that the whole shebang, girl, swing, unhooked chains, went sailing 20 feet out into the woods behind our house. Two, the year I got diagnosed with mononucleosis, too late to cancel an Italian-themed dinner party. So I stood in front of a stove for 2 hours, achy, glands swollen, stone cold sober, cooking pasta for 24, while my friends went through 6 bottles of wine. That was undoubtedly my 21st birthday. Beyond that, it blends into a murky party. Which years did we go to Chuck E. Cheese's? When did I get my Rainbow Bright doll? Which years were my father home, and which years had the army sent him off to the war college, Saudi Arabia, Bosnia? There is one constant in my birthday memories. When it came time for a cake, my mother would bring out whatever Sandra-friendly sweet she'd designed. Some years it was sunflower margarine Rice Krispie treats, some years it was an applesauce and cinnamon raisin bundt cake. I'd get my serving. Then we'd dish out the real dessert of cake or brownies or pie a la mode for everybody else. After singing, after blowing out candles, after presents had been opened, after everyone had eaten, someone would say it. Now, don't kill the birthday girl. Which meant no kisses, no hugs, no touch of a hand or mouth. From that point onward, anyone who touched me ran the risk of giving me hives or worse. Even today, it's a phrase I repeat as part joke and part prayer. Don't kill the birthday girl. It's the same at every holiday. My Uncle Jim is notorious for forgetting about my allergies, holding out a dish of ice cream and asking, "Want a bite?" He's the fun bachelor uncle, the one who rides a motorcycle and would give a little girl a wind-up sewer rat, complete with blinking red eyes, as a Christmas gift. Once upon a time, it would fall on my mother to protect me at the end of the night, when the aunts and uncles and cousins were making the rounds for goodbyes. Now, I step to the side on my own. Everyone understands why I avoid contact. Yet I can't help but wish it wasn't their last impression of me before the long drive home. I am allergic to dairy, including goat's milk, egg, soy, beef, shrimp, pine nuts, cucumbers, cantaloupe, honeydew, mango, macadamias, pistachios, cashews, swordfish, and mustard. I'm also allergic to mold, dust, grass and tree pollen, cigarette smoke, dogs, rabbits, horses, and wool. But in particular, I'm one of the more than 12 million Americans who's been diagnosed with food allergies, a figure that includes almost 4%, and in the most recent studies, almost 8% of all children.
That's a formidable list that you have there of things that you have trouble with. So at what age were you, how old were you when your parents were clued to the fact that, that you had food allergies?
Well, it was immediately clear that the typical, you know, feeding process that comes with having a newborn was not working for me. I couldn't seem to keep anything in. I was losing weight rapidly. I went back to the doctor within my first month of being out of a hospital. Unfortunately, my unwitting parents. And when you think about it, it's such a tremendously vulnerable moment to bring a child into the world. And the very thing they were trying to do to care for me, which was give me more milk, was the very thing making me sick. Yeah. So they figured out pretty quickly that's a key diagnostic for what turned out to be a broad spectrum of allergy.
And so for you then, essentially all of your life, this has been part of your life.
Yes, although, there are the list and of foods that I'm allergic to is always growing and may continue to grow. I mean, I still have not tried lobster on principle, but that would be a very expensive experiment to learn that, like shrimp, it's something I'm allergic to. Although if someone wants to buy me a lobster dinner, I'm game to try.
So this is, I'm trying to think about this, and as someone who has the luxury of not having to have that kind of worry. It must be strange to have a completely different relationship with food than I do, for example. There are things that I really like and there are things that I don't like, but there's nothing that I might eat. I might eat something and say, I want to spit it out because I just don't like it, but not because it's going to kill me.
Yeah. Well, it took me, it was not until my rebellious teenage years that I even gave myself permission to dislike a food. You know, up until that point, I thought of foods as being in two categories, safe and not safe. And many a meal did I have a totally plain baked potato and a totally boiled bland chicken breast in a restaurant because those were the only things they could guarantee would be safe. So definitely developing likes and dislikes and actually in the end really becoming something of a foodie, a self-educated expert on culinary matters has been one of the pleasures of going forward in life. Yeah.
Well, you would have to know if you went into a restaurant or someone had made something and was offering it to you, or I'm sure even with a prepared food or a packaged food, you would have to know everything that was in there. There can be no secret herbs and spices because you wouldn't want to take the risk that there would be something in there would be a problem. So you would have to know.
Right. I travel quite a bit for book tour and I've spent a lot of time down south, including as far down as Mississippi. And you still run into cultures that think of things in terms of secret recipes, secret ingredients. And it's very difficult to communicate, but I'm not trying to be a killjoy. I just need to know what I'm about to put in my mouth.
Well, I'm sure also that with packaged foods, or if you would eat in a restaurant, that there would be, I guess, particularly with a packaged food, there's proprietary stuff. So everything that's in there is not printed on that package.
Well, the FDA has, with an act called the FALCPA Act, they certainly became more rigorous in their insistence on food labeling. And there is a list of, there is a kind of big eight roundup of allergens, soy, dairy, tree nuts, where they're very specific. Even if a minor derivative is listed, it has to say in bold caps, tree nut right next to that. So they've come a long way in making things more clear.
That's interesting. Because that for you, you're okay with peanuts, apparently.
Yep.
Which is a big problem for a lot of people.
It's a little bit of a generational divide. I was born in 1980, and peanut allergy was not nearly as prevalent as it is in kids born in 1990 and later. So we don't know why that shift is happening. There's a number of theories. One is that as peanut butters became more cultured for the shelf instead of fresh made, we've kind of manipulated the protein past the point of no return, and the body's responding to that.
Okay. So you would be okay with the peanut, but the tree nuts. You can't have those.
Oh, I can eat almonds. You know, it's so ironic. Okay. I cashews are a real problem, and actually it's funny how food trends affect me. Two of my allergies that used to not be a big deal were mango and cashew. And now mango has become the trendiest garnish. I mean, you know, McDonald's is offering mango smoothies. Mango shows up randomly on sushi. And it's extremely frustrating because I'm not trained to look for it. Similarly with cashews, the rise of the raw food movement and in the vegetarian movement, cashew butter has become a really popular fatty ingredient. And to me, it looks like tahini, which is not an allergy of mine. And so you really have to be very careful. It goes back to what you said about being fully educated.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of focus is a poet and essayist, Sandra Beasley. She is the author of the book, Don't Kill the Birthday Girl, Tales from an Allergic Life. It's a memoir. It's published by Crown about her experiences growing up with food allergies. And she's here on the campus for a visit. She'll be giving a reading later this afternoon. And if people want to call in, you got questions or comments, 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. So you're a poet, and in your poetry, you have done some writing about your experiences growing up with allergies. What made you want to write this book, Don't Kill the Birthday Girl?
Well, yes, as I mentioned, I do have a sequence called Allergy Girl, which it dealt with a fairly raw emotional dimension of having this medical condition that changed how I related to the world. But even though, you know, I can hopefully a fairly adept poet, I just found that those line breaks in that space wasn't big enough to contain the story that needed to be told with food allergies. I mean, one of the unique things about this book, I hope, is that so much of the dialogue is either very sciencey out there. It's the New York Times science column, or it's a conversation between in the medical community, or it's super boiled down, the nut-free, dairy-free, egg-free cookbook. There hadn't been anything that wasn't accessible, fun, illuminating narrative of what it was like to actually live with this. But it was important to tell the story of others and not just my own. So I did interview parents of children with peanut allergy. I did attend medical conferences. I did research, you know, how did soy become such a trendy super ingredient and everything. So I tried to really do my homework as well as reach back into my own stories.
Yeah. So I know, certainly, because I know some people who have children who have food allergies, and that it's something that I think for them has been, maybe continues to be, really frustrating. It's hard for them to find information. It's hard for them to figure out, you know, how it is they're going to feed their kids. And I'm sure that they wonder about, well, what's the long term for my child if they're not going to grow out of this, if this is something that they're going to have to deal with, you know, what's that going to be like for them? And it seems that there, this is a niche that this book will help fill that and speak to some of those issues, I think.
Well, I think there are other medical conditions that have a similar social aspect as well as a medical aspect, such as diabetes or celiac disease, where it really affects how you live your life in a daily way. But one of the differences with those diseases is that they are often hereditary. So, you know, the mother with the child with celiacs is more likely to have celiac herself. Whereas with food allergies, there's a predisposition to have allergies that's inherited, but specific allergies are not. And so, as you say, it's often parents who have no firsthand experience trying to relate to kids, and it's something as basic as not knowing the vocabulary of what a reaction feels like inside their bodies, mm-hmm. you know, and so that can be very scary for a parent.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure it could be scary for the individual who experiences it too. Do you have a memory of what sometime early in your life when you had a really bad reaction?
Oh, sure. We learned the hard way that I was allergic to pistachios because I tried one bite of one pistachio. And I just remember being curled up and feeling so helpless because the moment you swallow, you know that it's not going to go well, but there's nothing you can do to take back that moment in time. Also, in my adult years, so many people in this food allergy audience are right now dealing with children. And I think it's so important to think about the challenges that come later in life. I'm traveling on my own for this book tour, and I experienced a reaction in Miami last year. And when I tried to call somebody for help, because I was behind the wheel of my car, I reached somebody and they couldn't understand what I was saying because my throat was so swollen. And at that moment, it's in South Beach on a Friday night where nobody knew where I was, I panicked. Those moments are deeply frightening.
Well, what happened? I mean, what was it that triggered this?
Well, that was that reference point that I made earlier to cashew butter's dangerous resemblance to tahini actually came out of a raw food wrap. And the irony was that the restaurant manager had specifically come out to tell me how proud they were of how well they took care of people with food allergies. But he was so fixated on my allergies to dairy and egg, and steering me towards the vegetarian option that he'd missed that other glaring factor. I pulled over and ended up finding a reasonably nice hospital in Miami. The very first thing was I literally pulled over with my blinkers on, and the concierge of the hotel that I pulled over came out, and I opened the door of my car and I just lost it. I was violently sick, and I looked at him helplessly and I said, "I'm not drunk, I swear. I'm having a medical emergency." I was kind of desperately embarrassed by that moment. Yeah. And there's vulnerability and there's embarrassment during those reactions.
Yeah. It must be tough to have made the transition or work on making the transition between being a little girl where your mom and dad were your guardians. They were looking out for you. They were protecting you. You could have the feeling that knows they had your back. And then to go from that to being a grown up, well, you pretty much have to do that for yourself.
Yeah, I mean, I essentially had not eaten outside the house in a restaurant except with my parents present, which is a very common thing. But as I try to remind parents, if you don't give your teenagers that experience of navigating menus on their own, you don't want their first time doing that to be prom night. And that was a difficulty, because sooner or later, eating out and sharing food in social spaces becomes part of your pact with society. It becomes can have a professional dimension. You can have to go to a work lunch and things like that. And so learning to step outside the protectiveness of my parents and be on my own was a challenge.
Yeah. It's funny how when I'm coming up to have some particular conversation with somebody and I will come across something, read something that connects to it in an odd way. And I just had this experience yesterday when I was reading the newspaper, and there was a story about the Iceman. I don't know if you remember. This is this guy more than 5,000 years old, and they found him in 1991 in the Italian Alps. And they have been working on him to try to understand what early humans were like, what their experience was. And they have just completed sequencing his DNA. And what it said in this article was, and the thing that hit me was that he was lactose intolerant.
Oh, goodness.
And so I'm thinking, so the other thing that was really interesting was that they somehow made some determination that he also would have had a tendency toward heart disease. And if he hadn't died by being shot with an arrow, the person who was quoted in the article said, well, he probably would have had a heart attack. So I'm thinking 5,000 years ago, heart disease and lactose intolerance were things that were part of the human experience. So this is a long way of getting to the point that it seems like these kinds of things have been part of being human, maybe from the earliest days that we had humans.
Yeah, and it's interesting to see. I think that those with food allergies tend to respond two ways. One is that, and this is true for me, I've adopted a very simple, there's plenty of foods I can eat. For me, nuts are helpful, but also a kind of Mediterranean diet, lots of fruits and vegetables, chicken, lean proteins. And actually, other than the food allergies, I'm a fairly healthy person. I don't get sick a lot. It's not that my medical condition puts me in a position where I can't eat. And so I think that there's something to be said for adopting that attitude. Sometimes people with food allergies seem to jump through all of these hoops to mimic the foods they wish they could eat, and they eat these incredibly artificial processed things with 15 ingredients that are trying to recreate a cookie. And I just wonder if that's really kind of philosophically the wrong direction to go in.
Hmm. Well, and I'm sure that when someone would hear that, when you read that list of the things that you are allergic to, and if they don't have that particular issue themselves, that I'm sure that that's what the first thing they're going to think goes, well, my God, how do you live? What do you eat? Well, yeah, okay, so there are a lot of things on that list, but then you don't think about all the other things that are just fine.
Right.
So it sounds like you get by just fine. It's not like you have to you know, live on three different things.
Right. Although I do, on occasion when I'm traveling, hit a wall in terms of what's accessible, because people don't realize, you know, airports think that they offer such a wider variety of food nowadays, but they don't, they forget that every salad has cheese on it, little things like that. Mm-hmm. And so I have had days where I have to rationalize what I call the potato diet, where somehow hash browns in the morning, a baked potato at lunch, and a French fries at night, I have to convince myself that is kind of like three different dishes, even if they're all tuber-based. But yeah.
Is there some particular thing that you really have to be conscious of in terms of nutrition to make sure that you're getting everything that you need?
You know, all the other women in my family are about 2 inches taller, and I think I got the short end of the stick in terms of the calcium. That's the one thing. But, you know, other than that, you have to be aware, but everybody has to be aware. Just keeping things in balance.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of focus is Sandra Beasley. She's a poet and essayist. She is the author of the book Don't Kill the Birthday Girl, Tales from an Allergic Life, which is a memoir of her experiences growing up and living with some pretty significant allergies. And she's here visiting the campus. We'll give a reading this afternoon at 4:30 in the Illini Union Bookstore in the Author's Corner. So you can stop by and hear her. And questions, comments, you know, whatever. You want to get involved in the conversation, you can do that as well. 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. So as you were growing up, particularly, say, when you were in grade school, your friends and the kids who were in school, how did they think that you were odd or was it just like, well, you were just one of them and, yeah, you had some issues, but that it wasn't any big deal?
Well, they knew I was different. And it was funny how, you know, the roller coaster could run, because some days it really did feel like I missed out on all the good stuff. I mean, I remember we had a contest each month where the person who read the most books would get a certificate as a prize. And the certificate was a free pan pizza from Pizza Hut. And darned if I didn't win that. More months than not, and then my friends would kind of bid on who got my free pizza, you know, because or being sent out of the room during a pizza party in class. We would do secret Santas or secret Valentine's Day buddies, and somebody, without meaning to, you know, the last big day would be a huge Hershey's Kiss, or it would be a bottle of lotion from Bath and Body Works that was cucumber, and I would just kind of helplessly hand it back. But then on other days, it felt like I was the lucky one, because I would get out of washing the cafeteria tables at lunchtime because there was such a risk of food being spilled. So there were little privileges here and there.
Mm-hmm. What about when you got older, and particularly when you were out on your own?
Well, I think that there's a whole other dimension of things to worry about that you just don't realize. I'm going to a friend's wedding this weekend, and I love my friend, but I don't love weddings. They're very difficult because you cannot surreptitiously substitute your own food. I actually have instituted what I joke are my stunt eaters, a couple of big strapping guy friends who will sit next to me and eat enough off my plate that it doesn't arouse suspicion among the catering crew. But, you know, it's those types of rituals. Things can create problems. There have been problems in Catholic communities because the Vatican's official position is that the host must contain wheat. And for those with severe wheat allergy or celiacs, that's of serious concern. And there's not a lot of wiggle room on it. Some people have left the faith over it.
So some people just put up with it and get sick, or that they just not take communion?
Well, I mean, I would argue that other than in the case of the mildest allergy or celiacs, simply getting sick is not really an option. You can have a catastrophic reaction from very minor exposure. Uh-huh. Or even if you opt not to take the communion wafer, if you're sharing a chalice of wine or grape juice with others who have had it, that cross-contamination can be an issue. So it's just amazing how our culture ritualizes food. It's not just a source of sustenance. It's a social pact.
That's true, and that's the thing. It's just so much part of family gatherings. It's part of social gatherings. Friends get together. It's so much woven into traditions involving food are so much woven into our life that's I'm sure that that's very difficult.
Well, and our policy was always, my mother would have never asked for a traditional holiday meal to be left off the table because I was going to be there. That's not how I would have wanted it. But that created an exclusion at the end of the night, and that form of avoiding being kissed or hugged or touched, having to be super careful not to use a common glass. I know other families of children with food allergy who have simply banned that food product from their house, which I think I understand that, but I always try to remind parents that you advocate for your child in a different way than that child will advocate for themselves. So for now, you might stop a woman at the door with a pie if your child is allergic to milk and eggs. But years from now, when that child has a household of her own and her mother-in-law comes to the door holding that pie, she's going to have a very different moment of judgment of, does she want to turn away mom-in-law and create that sense of alienation? No, she's probably going to let the pie come in and just try to hide it in a corner of the kitchen.
Mm-hmm. Would you like to read something else, maybe, that would show some other different dimension? I like the first reading, and right when I sat down and started looking at the book, I thought, well, okay, that's obviously the way to start because it kind of introduces the idea and particularly it explains what don't kill the birthday girl means. Maybe there's something else that you might like to read?
Sure. I think what I'll do, you know, you referenced early on an incident that happened when I was in elementary school where, again, the culture around me was trying to figure out what it meant that I had these allergies. Mm-hmm. And I'll read, especially for people who are just tuning in, I'll read a section that describes that.
Okay.
In the early 90s, many Americans were swept up by an interest in healthy eating. The U.S. Department of Agriculture began working on its food guide pyramid, which would be released in 92. When I first heard about this pyramid in fourth grade, I assumed it was based on the cuisine of Egyptians. Blame the World History Unit, we'd finished only a few days earlier. I imagined the pantries of ancient Cairo, fish, cakes of grain, honey, tiger nuts, and the occasional wayward canopic jar of kidneys. My fourth grade teacher invited a professional nutritionist, the mother of one of the other students, to come in for a lesson on maintaining a proper diet. She was a short, trim, olive-skinned woman with a clipped voice. She moved her pointer with enthusiastic precision over each part of the diagram, which presaged the portions that would be recommended by the USDA. She began by suggesting a soft, cushiony foundation of 6 to 11 servings of grain per day. This was in an era when Wonder Bread and brown rice stood side by side as equals in the ranks of starch. Beans and beef, eggs and nuts, all were packed neatly into the same block of 2 to 3 servings of protein. 3 glasses of whole milk. Yep, according to her diagram, that was the way to go. She tapped her pointer against the pyramid's penultimate tier. Milk prevents osteoporosis, she intoned. No one asked the obvious. What was osteoporosis? Instead, one of my classmates raised her hand. What if you don't drink milk? She asked. There's cheese if you don't like the taste of milk, the nutritionist replied. The important thing is your daily calcium intake. What if you can't eat cheese? The nutritionist paused. You should eat eggs, she said. What if you can't eat eggs? Another kid asked. I knew what they were getting at. 3 days earlier had been a much-anticipated pizza party, and I'd gone to the library instead to avoid exposure, which had prompted an explanation of my long list of food allergies. My classmate raised his hand. What if you can't have beef, or ice cream, or pizza, not even if you pick the cheese off? Well, the nutritionist said brightly, that's not somebody designed to survive, now is it? She continued on to fats, oils, and sweets as I slumped down in my chair.
So at no point did you stand up, or wave your hand and say, by the way, I'm that person. I'm that person that's well, not supposed to survive.
I think the fact that everybody turned and looked at me as soon as she said that. I mean, the poor woman, I think she just thought that they were playing, you know, they were being difficult. She didn't realize that they were articulating the experience of someone actually in
the
room.
They were actually thinking about you. Our guest, Sandra Beasley, she's a poet and writer, and she was just reading there from her book, Don't Kill the Birthday Girl. We'll have more after a very short break. This is Focus.
The Book of Revelation has some of the most dramatic and frightening images in the Bible. On the next Fresh Air, Elaine Pagels talks about the history of the Book of Revelation, and she talks about its author. Her new book is called Revelations, Visions, Prophecy, and Politics in the Book of Revelation. Pagels is a professor of religion at Princeton University. Join us.
this afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from AAA Storage in Urbana and Champaign, offering both climate-controlled and regular storage in all sizes with facility managers on site. AAA Storage, 1710 North Cunningham, Urbana, and 2202 North Market in Champaign.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. I'm David Inge, glad to have you with us. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics every week. Tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, the guest is Eric Kleinenberg. He's a sociologist at New York University, and we will be talking about his new book that's titled Going Solo, The Extraordinary Rise and Surprising Appeal of Living Alone. Also tomorrow in the 11 o'clock hour, we'll have another conversation with a candidate who will be involved in the primary here in the state of Illinois in just a couple of weeks. We're talking with some people running for the State House and for the Congress, and the guest tomorrow will be one of three Republicans competing for their party's spot on the ballot in the new 13th Congressional District. In fact, this is someone who is already a member of Congress, so in a way he is the incumbent, Tim Johnson, who now represents the 15th Congressional District. Then we'll have another candidate in that same race, another Republican, on the program Friday in the 11 o'clock hour, Frank Metzger. We're here weekday mornings, 10 until noon, 10 different topics every week. We always welcome your questions, comments. You can check the schedule by going to our website, which is WILL.illinois.edu. We're also on Twitter, Will Public Media, and you can find us on Facebook. In this hour, the guest is Sandra Beasley. She's the author of the poetry collections I Was the Jukebox and Theories of Falling. She's won a number of awards for her work. She makes her home in Washington, D.C., and she is visiting here in Champaign-Urbana and will do a reading if you'd like to meet her and hear more from her. She'll be at the Illini Union Bookstore in the Author's Corner this afternoon at 4:30. And of course, anybody can go out and look for the book that we're talking about here. The title of her book is Don't Kill the Birthday Girl, Tales from an Allergic Life, and it is published by Crown. And the number, if you'd like to call in, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. The email, will-talk, will-talk at illinois.edu. So when you were little, was there ever any idea that this is something that you would have grown out of? Or right away were your parents told, look, this is pretty serious, and Sandra will be dealing with this for the rest of her life?
You know, everybody always had a friend of a friend who'd outgrown all their food allergies. Yeah. And it is true that there are certain points in life developmentally where it is likely that your allergies will change or shift or ideally lessen. My tolerance of soy, I think, has at the very least stabilized and in some ways improved slightly. But my allergies with milk is as vicious as it's ever been. My allergies with mango, with cashews, and a few others have actually gotten worse over the years. I try to explain to people that allergies are not static. They change. Each individual allergy will change for that person over time. You can have different types of reactions. Lately, one thing I've been dealing with, and I know a lot of physicians are concerned about, is biphasic reactions, which are mediated by slightly different histamine than a traditional mast cell reaction. And the problem with a biphasic reaction is you fall asleep or you go forward, you go hours forward into your day without realizing you're having this reaction. And so, for example, I had a meal in New York that I later found out had shrimp in it. I didn't know that I was going to have a terrible allergic reaction. So I got on Amtrak to head back to D.C. And I woke up halfway through my trip with my completely disoriented, throat swollen shut, eyes swelling shut, not knowing what was going on. And I panicked and I opened up my phone and I tried to call my boyfriend, and the conductor came up, and I thought he saw that I was having a medical emergency. He said, "Ma'am, you have to shut your phone. Ma'am, you have to shut your phone." And I looked up, and I said, "What?" And he said, "You're in the quiet car. Shut your phone." And that was all he was concerned about. And I said, no, I'm having this problem." And he said, "Well, what is it?" I said, "Well, it's my dinner." And of course, he'd seen me get on that car hours earlier looking perfectly fine, and he didn't believe me. So you have those odd disconnects with your body. Its reactions change.
You must know a tremendous lot about the medical science behind allergies and allergic reactions.
Yeah, well, that was something, even though I had 30 plus years of life experience, that was something I really undertook as being part of the preparation for this book. And you learn really interesting facts like, you know, we think about food proteins, but even beyond that, there's the different epitopes, the different shapes of the food proteins. And for some people, your allergies might just be to particular epitopes. And so when a food is cooked or rendered or changed in some way, your body stops reacting to it. There's tremendous hope that for some kids, they might be able to help their egg allergies through what's called like a baked egg or a baked milk treatment, where because the food is presented in this cooked, highly heated form, the body is able to tolerate it and thus build up, kind of desensitize over time.
So, but in your case, that cooking things that you're allergic to doesn't help.
No, and I would be quick to mention that you should not try to do that without a strict doctor supervision. That's nothing to try doing at home. But unfortunately, my allergies are stubborn.
We have some callers here. Let's talk with them, and we'll start with someone. We have two people here, both in Urbana. We'll start with line two. Right here. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to share a childhood story of allergies. I've outgrown many of my allergies, fortunately, but still have allergies to eggs and nuts. But when I was a child, I was allergic to cow's milk or any dairy product from a cow. And growing up in Wisconsin, with the dairy state, that was problematic. But we used to go to Mrs. Day's Goat Farm in Ozaukee County once a week. It was about a 30-mile drive. And pick up goat's milk and goat cheese and all that. And I'll tell you, this is in the 50s, so it's a long time ago. And that's what I would eat, was goat milk, drink goat milk, rather. The whole family enjoyed goat cheese long before it was, kind of a gourmet treat. But, I have outgrown that allergy as well. But certainly remember various ways in which we had to cope with my allergies and how it affected the whole family. So thank you for the conversation this morning. It's very interesting.
Okay, thanks for the story.
And, you know, I'm actually a little envious. I wish the goat's milk worked for me. And I'll say that one of the difficulties I have going into restaurants, especially Mediterranean places, is I'll say no dairy, and they don't think of goat's milk as dairy. And so then when I have to kind of add that on, and then they look at me like, how picky are you? But that's a great story, and in some cases those substitutions are really a lifeline for a family.
Yeah. How about feta? Could you eat sheep cheese?
No. Feta is a real problem, too. And, you know, I did an interesting interview with a woman who'd grown up in the Depression era, and our caller mentioned briefly the kind of economic impact. She had memories of their family desperately trying to find whole grain bread, grains that weren't wheat-based, that she could eat, and the struggle to do that, and then the cost, you know, and so that's a real issue for some folks.
Okay, let's talk with somebody else here. This is Urbana, also at line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm glad for the program today. I actually have celiac disease, so a little bit different, but I had an experience where people are trying to be nice, and at a potluck, people had known of my condition and tried to make a dish that worked for me, and they were incredibly proud of themselves for making that effort. They had made some green bean casserole and taken off the crunchy onions, but went ahead and left the mushroom soup, which still, in my case, made it inedible. And I'm wondering if you had some tried methods for trying to deal with people who are trying to be nice but still fail.
I know. It's so difficult, and especially when you're being home hosted for a dinner, people are very quick to say, oh, well, just tell me what you're allergic to and I'll make it work. And they don't realize, you know, the whole point of being home hosted for an evening is to have a fun, relaxing time, and it's very difficult for someone with severe dietary restrictions to relax. And so I just try to always gently say, I ask people in advance, I say, please save the wrappers of things you set out. Just have an easy ingredient list that I can look at on my own. And if there's any way that I can contribute a dish that I will then know is the one safe dish, you tell me your menu. I'll find something that fits into the cuisine. I don't need to bring, I don't need to bring something sushi to like a Mediterranean meal. But there are small things you can do to kind of take control. But I completely understand your frustration. Another thing people don't even think about is cross-contamination with serving utensils at those house parties. Somebody goes through all the hoops and they make something that really is safe. And then the person in line in front of you uses the same spoon for the buttery mashed potatoes to your perfectly dairy-free quinoa, and then you can't touch it.
Yes, exactly, cross-contamination. And it's hard to explain that to people because they can't really see it or fathom it, that it's such a small piece can make a difference. Thank you.
Sure.
Thanks. I'm sure that's also something that for people, it's difficult for them to understand that for you to have a reaction, it wouldn't take very much of the allergen of,
oh,
of
a
the,
tiny
of
amount
the thing. So,
tiny
to the point
amount.
Where you know, going back to "Don't kiss the birthday girl," I could have a piece of birthday cake and I could give you a little peck and that would be enough.
It could be. I've had some pretty severe reactions from kisses, and that is a real mood killer on a date. But going back to that contamination issue, that also comes up when I'm traveling abroad. There are certain countries I've been to in Europe where I have to be honest, I don't have full faith that a fresh pan is being used to make my butter-free thing. And it's very difficult to communicate that concern without coming across like you're really kind of insulting their, you know, the cleanliness of their kitchen. And so those are delicate cultural matters.
Yeah. Speaking of kissing, I was just kind of wondering, what's it like to be the boyfriend of Allergy Girl?
It's fraught.
How is that? I'm sure that it is fraught.
You know, the point that I try to make is that every new relationship has trust issues. But in the cases where food allergies are on the table, that trust issue, a betrayal, is as undeniable as a hive on the cheek. I mean, if somebody assures me that they haven't had cream in their coffee and then they kiss me, we both know pretty quickly if they're lying. And that's very stressful. But you find the right person whose natural dietary habits fit your own. I probably will not end up with the person who's addicted to cottage cheese and butter at every meal. I dated one boy and I loved him, but he had this distressing habit of playing with his bowl of creamer at the end as we were talking over coffee. And it was, you know, little flicks of milk working their way across the table. And the confetti of a doomed relationship, yeah.
This is just I can't. That it'd be like sitting there juggling a hand grenade there while you're having dinner. I just can't quite fathom what that would be like for you.
It's funny you say that. I visited a friend's house and he has a 2-year-old daughter, and without even thinking, he'd given his girl a sippy cup full of milk, and I'm hunkered down on the floor trying to connect, trying to be Auntie Sandra, and every time she threw down her sippy cup, I jumped like a hand grenade was being thrown. And I was like, I'll do whatever you want, just stop throwing the cup. And I finally realized, wow, I'm being held hostage by a 2-year-old, you know, and in those moments you have to laugh. You have to just take in the absurdity of it all.
Yeah. So I'm wondering, you know, when you first meet a guy and you're getting to know one another, and are they completely at the beginning, are they completely accepting of the idea, or do they have this idea like maybe it's like, well, okay, I understand you have this sensitivity, but truly, I mean, a drop of creamer, is there some testing, or is it that they don't really, it's hard for him to really get it and really understand what it's like for you?
It's really hard for people to wrap their heads around it if they haven't had any firsthand experience. I mean, certainly having this book out in the world has at least meant that I haven't had to bring up the food allergies as much, so that's been helpful. And, you know, I don't want to overemphasize it. There's have been a few worst-case scenario kisses, but there have also been plenty of times where, you know, the food that somebody had ingested didn't cause a problem at all. And there are little things that you can do. It's not even so much, you know, the saliva in the mouth breaks down the food proteins so quickly that it's not even as much of a problem of what people have eaten as what's around their mouths. So unfortunately, men with beards I've had more problems with than men without, because the facial hair holds that oil and crumbs and things. I know I'm making this sound so sexy.
Uh-huh. Yeah, speaking as a bearded man, yes, it's definitely very exciting. I do try to wash like after meals, but yeah, that's more than you need to know. I think that I read, is it true that your allergies were so bad that your condition would fall under the Americans with Disability Act?
Yeah, absolutely. And right now there's a rising trend of students creating protection plans for themselves in elementary schools using that as leverage, which can be appropriate. But, you know, it because otherwise, one of the things that I'm learning as I grow older was that there were so many times when I was younger where I thought I was grateful just to have things withheld from me that would have hurt me. It's so funny, I wouldn't have even thought about asking for comparable treatment or a substitute that would have been, you know, equitable. But I'm now watching with awe and admiration this generation of kids with food allergies coming after me who are really fighting to have themselves taken care of and taken care of equally.
Well, was it your experiences in school, as we talked a little bit before about, you know, what it was like for classmates and how your friends related to you, how for in terms of the teachers and administrators and the that part of it, were they pretty much understanding and looked out after you and took into consideration your condition?
I was fortunate in that I didn't encounter a lot of skepticism about the validity of the allergies, but there certainly was a lot of bureaucracy, a lot of forms, a lot of hoops that had to be jumped through. There's a concern right now, you know, the current medical advice is to administer EpiPens, epinephrine injections, upon first sign of a reaction if a child is known to have a severe food allergy. But a lot of schools, they're only comfortable with the nurse doing that. And so, for example, what if that child wants to go on a field trip with his or her classmates where there's going to be food offered on the field trip? Can the child take part? If so, and the child has a reaction, is anybody authorized to set off the EpiPen? You know, there's all of these kind of complications.
And this is, for people who don't know, this is a thing that has a particular kind of drug in it that people who have severe allergies or worry that they might have that kind of reaction, it's a thing that you can have and you can put it in your pocket that if you get in that situation, you can poke yourself with this.
Yeah.
Give yourself an injection of this stuff that can...
And I've tried to ask parents to use that information to empower their children, because we're really fortunate. We have a severe medical condition, but we can carry around the top grade medication emergency response with us and administer it as needed. If a doctor were standing right there beside me, he or she would do the exact same thing. And that's actually empowering in a sense. And I try to remind people of that. But yes, going back to that romantic world, every boyfriend at some point jokes about looking forward to the moment he gets to shoot me with the EpiPen. I have not allowed any to have the pleasure thus far.
Have you done it in their presence?
This is a different radio program. It's one of those things where I would much prefer to go straight to hospital care if it gets that serious.
Yeah, if only this was that kind of radio program. Some in my dreams could be that kind of radio program. So we've talked about this book that you've written, Don't Kill the Birthday Girl, and I mentioned a couple times that you were a poet. Is there some way in which growing up having this part of your life experience pushed you in the direction of being a writer? Can you does that connect in any way that's all direct?
Absolutely. I mean, I think kids with food allergies are tremendously self-aware, tremendously attentive to their environments. I mean, we have to be like tuning forks. If there's a bowl of mixed nuts in the room, we need to know where it is and is it going to get passed around to us, so to speak. And also, for kids trying to understand medical conditions at a young age, a lot of times the doctors will use metaphors. So for me, the metaphor was one of my bloodstream and the cells in my blood being like a Fisher-Price workbench with those holes of all the different shapes. And if the shape of a food protein matched the shape of the hole, I would have a reaction because it would click and it would start to react. And I think that when you're trying to understand complex ideas in those kind of very visceral, image-driven ways, it does prime you to be a poet. It's a different way to think about the world.
And did that help? I mean, that's something that you write about in the book where you relate this conversation of you were talking with, at some point, some doctor, and you were trying to figure out, well, what's going on here? And he was trying to find a way to explain it to you in a way that would make sense. Did that actually... that explanation actually work for
you? It did,
you?
Yeah, no, it did help. I mean, there were some small disconnects. I remember he used the phrase immunoglobulin, and for years I thought of it as immune goblin. I thought of immune goblins in my blood. And so, you know, obviously you can't take it all in at once, but it was a good model. That was actually my allergist who I had for... 30 years. He gave me a shot on my first birthday, and he just retired this past summer. So giving him this book actually was a real pleasure to tell him what an impact and how helpful he was.
That must be remarkable for someone to have that continuity of care with an individual patient for that much time.
Oh, we paid for it out of pocket at times. That's, you know, people with these types of tricky conditions develop a tremendous loyalty to their doctors.
Yeah. Tell me about poetry and when you were drawn to that kind of writing.
I was really fortunate in that I was exposed to poetry early on. In third grade, I was part of a school program where we got pulled out of class once a week and we were taken to a place where we could workshop our poems. And the woman was I later learned she was known as the Poetry Lady of Fairfax County. Her name was Rose McMurray, and she was all curves and big hair and fake eyelashes and perfume and flowing scarves. And she would walk into the room and say, "Today we are poets." And I thought, well, okay, I can do that. Plus, it got me out of class, which meant I loved it.
Yeah. We're coming down. We have a couple of minutes left. Would you like to read a poem? It wouldn't necessarily have to be an allergy-related poem. Could be anything, if you'd like to do that and give people a little sense of poetry.
Sure, yeah. I think that I'll read... Oh, you know what? I'll read, since you set me up to be able to read any poem, I'll read a poem called Cherry Tomatoes. And there's a funny subtext that is allergy specific, which is that I put off trying a lot of foods for as long as I could. And tomatoes was one of those foods. But in addition to putting it off for the sake of a fear of allergy, it was also that I had some family dynamics that shaped our attitudes towards them. Cherry tomatoes. Little bastards of vine. Little demons by the pint. Red eggs that never hatch, just collapse and rot. When my mom told me to gather their grubby bodies into my skirt, I'd cry. You and your father, she'd chide. The way each time I kicked and wailed against sailing, my dad shook his head, said, you and your mother. Now, a city girl, I ease one loose from its siblings, from its clear plastic coffin, place it on my tongue, just to try. The smooth surface resists, and erupts in my mouth, seeds, juice, acid, blood of a perfect household. The way, when I finally went sailing, my stomach was rocked from inside out. Little boat, big sea, handful of skinned sunsets.
Oh, that's lovely. That's very, very nice. And I'm glad to hear that you can, in fact, eat tomatoes.
I know. And actually, once I add those in with the potatoes, I've got at least a two-course meal on when I'm on the road.
Our guest in this hour is Sandra Beasley. She's essayist and poet. Her book, if you'd like to read the book about her life experiences, her memoir of being an allergic girl, being allergy girl, the title of her book is Don't Kill the Birthday Girl, Tales from an Allergic Life, and it's published by Crown. She's also published these collections of poetry, I Was the Jukebox and Theories of Falling. If you're interested in sampling some of her poetry, and you can do that and meet her as well. She will be giving a reading at the Alina Union Bookstore on the U of I campus this afternoon at 4:30 in the Author's Corner. So anybody who's interested in stopping by and hearing more from her and meeting her should do that. And thanks very much for being
here.
Thank
you. My pleasure.